This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Anita Rao. Under normal circumstances, mid to late summer is a time for buying new clothes and school supplies for K-12 students. It's when they get excited about seeing teachers and friends face-to-face after months spent apart. But this year, more than half of students enrolled in North Carolina's public schools will not be returning to traditional in-person classrooms. 2 weeks ago, Governor Roy Cooper announced that due to COVID-19, each district in the state could decide whether to reopen schools under a hybrid of in-person and online instruction or begin the year online only. With us to discuss various districts' approaches to reopening is Anna Pogarcic. Anna is a Summer 2020 Engagement Fellow with Education NC. She's also the incoming editor-in-chief of the Daily Tar Heel. Anna, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So I'd love to talk about the reopening trends and kind of paint a broad picture of the state of North Carolina. How many public school districts are planning to reopen in person as compared to fully online, as compared to hybrid versus online?
I don't think I can give you a specific number on districts, but I think it's safe to say that the majority of North Carolina's public school students are going to be doing at least some remote learning. Many districts have already announced plans to be fully remote for the first 9 weeks, and even those who have chosen to go under Plan B with moderate social distancing in person are incorporating at least some virtual learning.
So we know that the plans for starting online and the number of weeks schools are going to do this is varying district by district. Asheville City Schools, for example, has said 9 weeks of remote. New Hanover County School says online only when they reopen next month. So do we know what's going to happen at the end of these remote periods for those that have said a defined amount of time, like 6 weeks or 9 weeks?
We honestly don't know that at this point. Many districts haven't been specific about what they're going to do when the remote learning period ends, but based on how they've made their decisions so far, a lot of school leaders and even the state board has said they're basing it on science and COVID-19 numbers in North Carolina. So I imagine whatever decision they make at that point will also be based on that.
As school districts have gone about making these decisions and getting feedback, whose opinions have been solicited and what have those processes looked like?
Yeah, many school leaders are choosing to survey mostly parents or the staff and teachers that they have in their districts. I recently went to a school board meeting in Greene County out in eastern North Carolina, and the superintendent there told me that they sent out a call survey to basically every single family in the district to ask them about their opinions for the school year. And he told me they heard back from about 50% of families. And of that 50%, he said 60% told him that they wanted at least some in-person component. And he told me that's kind of why they decided to go with Plan B and have some in-person and remote learning for students this year. But that obviously is a very important demographic. You know, parents are thinking about how they're going to work and how they're going to balance that with their school's remote. But students are just as important in this equation as parents are and even faculty. And I haven't seen a very systemic pattern of districts talking to their students about what they want. And even if they're going to choose remote learning, how that can be best made beneficial for the students.
So within these hybrid models that are existing throughout the state, what are the variety of plans that have been proposed? What is this hybrid learning going to look like?
Yeah, I think it's important to note that there's not really one universal definition of what Plan B looks like. If a district decides to go with Plan B, it's really up to them how they decide to make that work. The state has laid out a couple different scenarios and how that can work, but we've already seen a lot of variation. For example, Greene County, like I mentioned, they're doing a system where they basically have students going in two tracks. One track will be in person 1 week while the other is a remote, and then they'll flip-flop throughout the semester. But some districts like Durham Public Schools are having their K-8 students be in person while high school is online. So you can see that there's a lot of variation and not really any sort of universal definition or standardization. But basically, as long as a school district is doing in-person education and they're laying out social distancing guidelines and things like that, they're following a Plan B model.
I know that was the initial plan for Durham, but they have started for online only for everyone K-12 for the first 9 weeks.
Yeah.
So they didn't make that shift. So for these Plan C remote only instructions, I mean, there are so many factors that are considered that pediatricians, you know, are really saying we have to think about how schools provide a variety of functions to students. They provide childcare, they provide food, they provide a safe space. And so as districts plan for these remote only options, how are they considering some of these other challenges and some of these other needs that schools fill?
Yeah, I mean, it definitely varies district by district, but I know a lot of districts are considering how they can maintain kind of the school nutrition programs that they had, especially during the spring semester, where, like, you know, school buses would deliver food to neighborhoods and how they could continue to provide those kinds of services. but there's not, again, just like with the Plan B model, there's not really a standardized method of how they can continue to do that in remote learning scenarios. And the state hasn't provided a whole lot of detailed guidance on that. They're mostly just trying to figure out how they can make schools that choose the Plan B model continue to maintain the safety of the students and their staff.
Anna Pogarchich is a Summer 2020 Engagement Fellow for Education NC, also the incoming Editor-in-Chief of the Daily Tar Heel. Thanks so much, Anna.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
So among those public school districts planning to start off the school year with face-to-face instruction is Iredell-Statesville, where Nicole Tilley is the principal of Lake Norman Elementary School. The district's hybrid plan will serve K through 8 and some high school students. Nicole joins me now. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So you are in the minority of districts in the state that are starting in this hybrid model. And I would love to know how you are adjusting this plan for your own school. There are going to be students that are attending 2 days a week, and there'll be some deep cleaning days in between. So how are you preparing for all of those logistics?
So right now, yes, all the elementary schools in Iredell-Statesville schools are starting with 2 days. Kids would come for 2 days. One group of kids would come for 2 days on Monday and Tuesday. And so some schools are doing like A through L. My school's doing A through M. Our district kind of gave us guidelines, but every school is heavier, some on certain ends of the last names. And then the second half would come Thursday, Friday. And when those kids are not at the building, they are remote. Wednesday is designated remote day for all, and a deep cleaning day, as well as Friday after schools. And so that's what all the elementary schools are doing here. And we're also looking at, as space is needed, and you know, we can bring in, say, kids that have need additional help, they could come, we're working with, they could come in 4 days. And we're partnering with our middle and high schools to ensure that we're meeting the families' needs that, you know, have to swap to a Monday, Tuesday versus a Thursday, Friday. So it's really a collaborative effort to ensure that we're trying to work with our families, but also meeting the needs of our students. And then there's also a virtual option that every school is providing. And so I have students that are on a virtual option, a part of my school.
So in order to keep students safe, you've been required to keep them 6 feet apart during the learning day, and that has encouraged you all to look into potentially doing some outdoor learning. Tell me about that and how that would work.
Yes. So right now I'm actually working with like my PTO and some of my parents and along with my staff to determine what are good areas for outdoor learning, shade. And I think every school is kind of different with this. Like I actually have a gazebo on my campus. And so we're looking at that as a possible outdoor learning spot. We are asking as a part of our classroom supply list that students bring like a beach towel with them so that makes that possible. If that's an option, and depending on also weather and, you know, the temperature, we're definitely trying to make that work so that kids can get outdoors a little more, even outside of that, the scheduled structured recess time. So that way that kids can get that fresh air and separate even more than that 6 feet.
So you are a parent yourself, and you have been working with kids K through six for a long time. And I'm curious, I mean, how do you think that they are going to adapt to this model, to being sometimes at home, to being sometimes outside in this North Carolina humidity?
Yeah.
What do you think that's going to look like?
You know, I'm going to be honest with you as a parent. When the decision was made, our kids looked to us for that reaction. And before I could even make that reaction, my kids were like, yes, I am excited. They were excited about the smaller groups. My youngest, she is a ball of energy, and she loved the idea that she was like in a smaller group with her teacher, and she got her teacher more to herself. She loves her teacher. And so when I looked to her for that, I was like, you know, kids are resilient, and they're looking to us for like our reaction for when these decisions are made. And I think for me as a parent, before I even could give my positive reaction, my own kid did that. And I was like, you know, we're gonna be okay. And the same with virtual, like it depends on my enthusiasm with that virtual. If I were to decide, you know, my husband were to stay home and do the virtual option with my child, that, you know, if he's doing it at home, they look to us for that reaction. And so my kids, I do feel like I have the right staff. I do feel like Iredell-Statesville has the right staff, that we're going to have that positive energy and that provide that comfort to parents, and work with our kids to ensure that they're prepared and they know what it looks like. My kids are actually going to use my kids as models to do like a virtual tour of what it would look like for kids coming back because things are going to be a little different. So parents can show that video to prepare kids as well.
I only have about a minute left, but what advice would you have for parents who are working, are essential workers and have to go back to this full-time schedule and are not going to really have the bandwidth to be at home and support the virtual learning? How are you planning to support those parents?
I would say this with any parent, contact the school. There's a lot of resources. My county has provided, and I know not just my county, any county, it has partnered and provided different resources to hopefully remove as many barriers as possible for that. So to contact the school that we have those resources to hopefully meet those needs and remove any barrier for learning.
Nicole Tilley is the principal of Lake Norman Elementary School in the Iredell-Statesville District. Thank you so much, Nicole.
Oh, thank you.
Just ahead, we are going to hear from three North Carolina public school superintendents about how their districts are approaching the start of the new school year. You're listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Anita Rao. Though many of the state's larger school districts have announced plans to continue remote education this fall, Iredell-Statesville Schools, which has an enrollment size of about 21,000 students, is on track to implement a Plan B program. Kindergarten through eighth grade students will be divided into two groups and attend schools in person on an alternating schedule. Some high schoolers will also have this option, while those attending the district's two largest schools will remain at home. Virtual learning is also offered to all K-12 families. I talked earlier this morning with Superintendent Jeff James about Iredell-Statesville Plan B, and we started the conversation talking about why they chose to start the school year with Plan B given the current COVID-19 trends in the state.
Districts started putting plans together as soon as this hit us last year. Of course, we polled our teachers to see how they felt about the safety of our buildings. The good thing about Iredell-Statesville Schools is most of our schools have been renovated or are in fairly new condition. They have newer HVAC systems. There is a huge logistical map that we have put in place and been working on for about 2 months. The schools, we're going to social distance, so 6 feet apart. Of course, the governor has required that we wear a mask. We're providing face shields for students that have a medical issue, can't wear a mask. And we're sanitizing just constantly the buses and taking temperatures. You know, we're a continuous improvement district. So as more and more metrics come in, if there happened to be a significant spike in the county, I'm sure the board and I would sit down again and look at the data and, you know, possibly come up with a different decision. We're not saying this is set in stone. We feel like we at least need to get kids back, get some form of normalcy back into their lives and ours as educators, and then continue to look at the metrics and listen to our Department of Health and Human Services, our county officials, state officials. And if we see a spike or a rise start and we feel it's detrimental, then we'll make that hard decision, most likely to go to Plan C.
So your school district will be one of the guinea pigs to see how this existing safety precautions and standards work. So I'm curious about what your current plan is for dealing with a student or teacher who tests positive for COVID-19. What are you going to do?
Absolutely. So we'll be temperature checking before they enter a building. So we have isolation rooms already set up. So if a child has a temperature, we'll isolate them, call the parent. And, of course, from that point, the health department gets involved with the parent, make sure that testing is occurring, and then we go from there. And, of course, right now the metric is you have to have 5 confirmed cases before Department of Health and Human Services is requiring us to shut the school down.
But we know that kids are more likely to be asymptomatic or pre-symptomatic carriers, meaning they could not necessarily show that fever, but they may still be carrying COVID-19 and could pass it on to a teacher, for example. So how will you balance kind of the safety of teachers, given that there will be some lack of knowledge about whether or not the kids in the classroom are asymptomatic carriers?
Well, the teachers are required to wear a mask, and according to the CDC, wearing a mask will prevent the spread of COVID because it is airborne. So the mask will prevent that, plus teachers. And here's what we're doing. If we have a teacher that has any underlying conditions, what we're asking them to do is talk to our personnel department, and we will make arrangements for those teachers to do the virtual learning with students. So we're trying to do the absolute best with the hand we were dealt, And that includes all stakeholders. That includes parents, teachers, administration. Because, again, the other side that's being left out of the equation is the parents. And I think they need a voice at the table. And what we're doing, child care is a big issue. So we're actually going to roll out a plan in Iredell Statesville to provide multiple sites of child care. And, again, going by those guidelines, where the spread has occurred with COVID has typically been rest homes where it started, and again, groupings like at the beach, unfortunately at bars and pools where people congregate together, unmasked, and not abiding by the CDC guidelines. So in my opinion, it's going to be much safer sitting in a classroom than it would be going to a retail establishment or out to a restaurant that's full or other places, pools, the beach.
Well, the thing about pools and the beach is there's airflow and air circulation, and we know that indoors is a particular danger in this current moment. So that's one of the, I guess, additional challenges of being inside a school. But I'm curious about what you're planning to do for those virtual students, those that don't feel safe coming to school, those teachers that want to stay at home. What is the virtual academy option going to look like?
So, of course, when we ended last year, we were thrown into this overnight. So as we're telling parents, you can't judge any school system, in my opinion, in the state or in the country, when we were thrust into this in a matter of days, going from being face-to-face to virtual. So I would say across the nation, they may have been under school systems that were more prepared, but I'm thinking not. We actually tried our best to scramble, get some things put together, but we have worked all summer long, our staffs have, our teachers, putting together online curriculum, and our goal for the rollout for virtual will be we're asking our teachers to be live online with Zoom at least 3 hours in the morning and, of course, 3 hours in the afternoon, and we gave them some additional time to plan each day because virtual learning does require a little bit more preparation, so we're trying to make that experience as good as possible, and we are looking into some technologies that actually would allow the students at home that day to come in through Zoom and remotely view the class and engage in the class. So we're trying to set up 10 of those pilots as sooner than later. And once we get that going, we don't know what tomorrow holds. So hopefully we'll have a synchronous environment that, may not be as good as face-to-face, but will be close. But the key thing here, I think, that, again, that's not being talked about is the impact on families with child care and being out of school. And I can tell you, I've had parents tell me as much as $100 a day for child care. And most families cannot afford that. So one of the wage earners is going to have to quit to stay at home with kids in this virtual environment. So it's a hardship. I think it's scary for, I'm an administrator. We've been deemed essential workers, so I plan on being here. I don't want to expose any of our educators by any means to harm. So again, those that have underlying conditions, we're asking them to do the paperwork and get set up to do the virtual. And those that feel comfortable, teach. And our survey initially said 87% of our staff wanted to come back face-to-face.
Jeff James is the superintendent of Iredell Statesville Schools. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
We continue our conversations with superintendents now with leaders of two of the state's largest public school districts, Durham Public Schools and Wake County Public Schools. Durham Public Schools was one of the earliest in the state to announce a reopening plan. The district initially decided on Plan B before ultimately deciding to start the year with Plan C, remote learning. Wake County Public Schools is also starting the year with all remote learning. Here to discuss how districts accommodating tens of thousands of students, staff, and faculty are addressing the unique challenges of long-term remote education are Pascal Mubenga, Superintendent of Durham Public Schools, and Kathy Moore, Superintendent of the Wake County Public School System. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you for having us.
Good afternoon.
So, Kathy, you just heard Jeff James talking about their Plan B. Wake County is starting with Plan C, virtual learning only. And I'm curious to know what this is going to look like in the fall and how it compares to what students and families experienced in the spring when the shift to virtual was much more rapid. How have things changed in what you're planning?
There are a number of differences. The spring was crisis management. And in the spring, there were some decisions that came down from either the governor's office, North Carolina DHHS, or the Department of Public Instruction at the state level that caused some of the differences from what we will see now. For example, in the spring, there wasn't a formal way to take attendance. Remote learning was encouraged of districts, but not required. Grades were not issued. And we were, quite frankly, in crisis management at that point in time. So what we've had an opportunity to do as we've worked through the summer, contemplating the potential to really open with having to start with remote instruction, we now have some systems and structures around required time that students may be online and expect to see teachers, so that we're providing a more consistent academic experience and face time with teachers from what was done last spring. There will be assessments and assignments will be graded. There will be a higher expectation of accountability for both the teachers and the students with attendance as well. So we do believe that what parents will experience, we are putting all of the work in place to make sure that we are able to achieve a higher level of both student participation and engagement than what we had last spring.
So, Pascal, as you design the learning schedule for Durham, I'm curious about how you think teachers can best support the physical and mental health needs of kids during remote learning and prioritizing holistic wellness in this time when families are juggling a lot.
Thank you for having us. I think we have a very realistic goal as we're moving forward with our remote learning. At this time, we really have a schedule that's going to be synchronized as well as synchronized learning. And we are very mindful going from pre-K all the way to 12. There are going to be some grade level that they will be engaged for 2 hours maximum a day. And then there are going to be some other grade level that will be involved 5 hours a day. And also looking at our schedule that we'll be presenting to our board tonight, we have a block a day. I think it's Wednesday that our students are going to be engaged with their guidance counselor and social work and things of that nature to make sure that they're getting all the social and emotional needs as well. So we're not going to be throwing those kids out there for 6 or 7 hours to be able to spend time on the screen time. So I think our schedules are really well balanced so that our students will be able to meet their academics needs as well as their social and emotional needs as well.
Kathy, how about kids with special needs and students who are English language learners? There are obviously extra complications and challenges to engaging those students remotely. Talk about how you're working to accommodate those students and families.
So for our students with special needs, really how we provide services is driven by what's in their individualized education plan, their IEP. So if we have some time now as we move into the school year to communicate with families about potential changes that are needed in the IEP, how we will implement the IEP moving forward. So I think there will be both more communication and more opportunity to determine how to make that work. You know, specialized instruction is a subset of how we define general education. And the general education definition has not changed, even though what general education looks like has changed. So that does pose some problems with how we identify specialized education for students, because if it's changed for general ed students, you would expect it to change for special ed students as well, but that's not well defined. And so that's something that superintendents have been asking about. Nevertheless, the most important tool that we have right now for both students identified with special needs or our ELL populations is looking at their individualized plans for learning and making sure that we are making constant contact with both the students and the families to ensure that we agree on and level set on what is needed and how we provide that.
Pascal and Kathy, I'm curious to hear you both answer this question. So I know both school districts have made a lot of effort to provide devices and hotspots to students and families who didn't have them so that they can access the materials from home. But even once students have devices, there are obviously a number of barriers to being able to learn well from home: adequate access to a quiet space, support from adults, sufficient food. So how are you each specifically working to support those needs of students and families? Pascal, I'll start with you.
Yeah, thank you for that. I think if I can just repeat what Kathy said earlier, last year was pretty much a crisis management. I think this time we are well prepared. So we have Chromebooks for all our students, and we have hotspots as well for those students that do not have connection. And we have been really spending a lot of time training our instructional leaders to be able to be familiarized with our learning management, which is Canvas, They have been with a lot of training so that they will be able to navigate that system before the teachers come back. So we're feeling really comfortable with the training that we've been able to share with them, and with some also some technology tools so that they will be able to evaluate what is happening in the classroom. So I know there are going to be other needs as well. How those students are going to be able to be engaged without parents being at home to be supervised them. So what we're doing here in Durham, so we're working with our community partners to come up with some learning centers. We pretty much are identifying probably about 6 schools depending on different regions of Durham. So we're going to have those places we're calling learning centers, and we're going to be able to provide support as well, being able to provide our food for those students that will be in those learning centers. So we're working collaboratively with our community to make sure that those parents that do not have really a place to be able to send their kids, we are especially working with those vulnerable families and to be able to provide that support.
Kathy, how about you? Food and safe space for your students.
So we are going to continue our food distribution programs that have been pretty remarkably successful since last spring. We are hopeful, however, one note that is important. We have some federal waivers from USDA that expire on August 31st that really provided flexibility with ensuring that we were meeting the needs of all of the students in our community. We are hopeful that those waivers will be extended so that we can continue to have a full-fledged program. Either way, we will continue to serve students who have needs in our community for their lunches and breakfasts. But again, we are hopeful that those federal waivers are extended. And then in terms of providing learning supports, you know, we've provided some FAQs around best practices for families, and we do that in English and in Spanish. We're looking at doing some videos as well to help promote that. I have done some interviews with some other outlets in the community, our Spanish language speaking stations and TV and radio, to try to promote how parents can support their children, because that's a large portion of our population. And we also are partnering with some community agencies like the YMCA, Boys and Girls Club, that have agreed to have some sites where families can access low-cost care for their children if the parents have to work. And at those care centers, there will be a mix of time that is dedicated to support the remote learning of the students, as well as time that is more typical, like a day camp that a student may have. So that if both parents have to work and they access one of these partners that we have with our care during the school day, that there'll be some support for the students in those environments as well.
Republican Senate Leader Phil Berger is urging families around the state to apply for state-funded vouchers to help cover the cost of attending private schools, as many private schools plan to reopen for in-person instruction, with the idea that that is going to provide a higher quality education to families this fall than remote learning offered by the public schools in their area. Kathy, I'll start with you, because I know you're on a tight time clock. Do you think for the families who can afford it, private school will provide a stronger education this fall?
I think that private schools, charter schools, are options and choices that families in our communities have, and some families enjoy the opportunity to apply for those options because they're able to accommodate those needs. I do not believe that they provide a better academic experience for students. I do believe that in-person instruction is best for students, and that is a goal that all of us have, to get back into the classroom. But we do believe that it's important that we understand as a community that that is a community goal, and that all of us have a role by following the 3 W's to make sure that we do get back into classrooms as soon as possible. And I think that, you know, to begin with, a lot of private schools already have a much smaller footprint in terms of the number of students they serve and class sizes and those kinds of things. And public schools, you know, we have 162,000 kids in 195 school buildings. So it's a much larger enterprise. And I, you know, I stand up what our kids do in academics any day against any other school in any other place.
All right, Pascal Mubenga, I'm going to ask you to stay with us, the superintendent of Durham Public Schools, but Kathy Moore, superintendent of Wake County Public Schools, I know you need to go, so thank you so much for your time today.
Sure. Appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Just ahead, we will continue our conversation with Pascal and also talk about how some parents are seeking the help of their community to share the workload and looking into learning pods and other alternative learning models. We'll continue our conversation about public school and public education in North Carolina on the state of things in just a minute. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Anita Rao. We are talking about public education in North Carolina as students prepare to return back to school this fall. Still with me is Pascal Mubenga, the superintendent of Durham Public Schools. So I'd love to put that similar question to you that I just put to Kathy. Many private schools in North Carolina are planning to reopen in person, and I'm curious about your thoughts on public school families who are switching away from their public school option and sending their kids to private school because they think that is going to provide a higher quality education this fall.
So I'm going to start responding to the question by giving some stats that we have here in Durham. I think when you're looking at our COVID infection rates in Durham is about 8%. And then if you dig even deeper for the school age population, 5 to 18, so the COVID infection rate is about 18%. So that's so high. Our ultimate goal is to be able to bring all students in person. But as we're looking at these COVID rates, infection rates, it's not safe. That's how we made that decision for Plan C. So I know there are parents that are trying to look for other options as DPS has made a decision to go to Plan C. But this is what I'll tell our parents. We're going to do the best we can. And our teachers and our principals, they've been really trained. They are going to be really pleased with our remote learning. So eventually, we hope after 9 weeks, when things improve, we're going to start looking at options how to be able to get back, depending on those metrics, whether or not there's going to be any improvement. Durham community, we are very dedicated. We like to be together. And I think we have been able to put a message out there from our DPS Education Foundation. It's really good to make sure that all the students in Durham community, they all go to DPS. We have outstanding, talented teachers, well-qualified, and that's doing really outstanding work. So pretty much I would agree with Kathy. Whatever we do in a public education, I'm not going to be able to compare with other entities or other organizations, but our parents have choices to make. But all I can tell them is, superintendent of DPS, we have the best quality education that we can offer to all the students in Durham.
So Durham Public Schools has launched its own fully online K-12 public school called Ignite Academy at the start of the school year. Could you provide us some distinctions between Ignite Academy and the Plan C, the virtual learning?
So Ignite Academy, our intent for now is a program. We hope after a year, we're going to move that program to a school. That's the only distinction that we have for now. But as a program, we are doing more things to be able to prepare that particular program to become a school. As we decided to go to Plan C, we were able to take all the students that were able to sign up for Ignite. They're going to go and matriculate back to their home-based school. And then at the end of the first 9 weeks, if we get to the point where we are going back to the building and those families that would like to have the kids to stay to Ignite and be able to finish up the year, that's an option as well. But our long-term intent is to make sure that Ignite is going to become really a school. So they have all the nuts and bolts of how to make online learning really effective, and they've been sharing those devices as well as those resources with everybody else in DPS.
Got it. Wonderful. Well, Pascal Mubenga is the superintendent of Durham Public Schools. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
As we've been talking about, remote education may be the route that most public school districts across the state are taking, but it is not an easy road for working parents or for students who work best in face-to-face classroom settings. A growing trend among parents seeking a sense of community during the online school day is establishing a learning pod, a small group of neighboring families who work together to share childcare, homeschooling, and tutoring responsibilities. With us now is Thad Domina, a sociologist and professor in the UNC Chapel Hill School of Education. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So there's been so much discussion online in neighborhood forums and Facebook groups. Everything has been blowing up about this concept of a learning pod. So tell me what a learning pod is.
Well, I think a learning pod refers to one of many, many different arrangements that families are sort of scrambling to make to deal with at least three different challenges that remote-only instruction presents to them. One challenge is that with remote-only instruction, I think it's right for parents to worry that their children may not have the instructional support they need to manage their time and to get through the day. It's going to be hard. The parents are going to worry, as we've heard other guests refer to, about childcare so that they can do their work. And then parents are going to worry about the opportunities for social interaction when kids are going to school atomized in their home via remote instruction. So parents have this really unprecedented problem. They relied on schools to do all of those things. And when school goes remote only, I think parents are right to think remote only is an imperfect solution to each of those three different needs. And so they're coming up with all sorts of different arrangements to try to patch together something that will work for their families and for their children.
I want to play a clip from a husband and wife that we heard from, Will and Jessica Perry in Fayetteville, and they've been talking about their personal struggle to juggle full-time work and online instruction for their youngest son. Let's listen to what they had to say.
We're pretty much having to stay right there with him. My husband works from home, so he's pretty much having to come into the kitchen where he is in between every call. So it's very difficult. I'm having to alter my schedule as well to try to work from home one day a week, but I'm not sure how we're going to be able to work and still be there for him, from 8 to 1 o'clock.
And the field that I'm in, as my wife said, I'm on the phone a lot. So I'm an insurance agent, so I'm fielding calls back to back to back to back. And, we have to remain in the queue, so it's not like I can come out for too long, having to deal with a stressful call that may pull me away from him for an hour in some cases, and then having to go back and check on him, patience and having to deal with that. That's nothing I would wish on anybody.
So that was Will and Jessica Perry of Fayetteville talking about the challenges of balancing work and remote education. I'm talking with Thad Domina, sociologist and professor at UNC School of Education. So Thad, obviously that sounds really challenging, and many parents and families are going through that and other even more complicated situations. So this idea of a learning pod could potentially be an appealing alternative. There are so many ways that these learning pods could look like. Could you give us a bit of an overview of the different forms that people are proposing that they take?
Yeah. So first of all, that sounds familiar. I work at home now, and it's always bouncing back and forth between work and children, and it's hard. It's stressful. Sort of beautiful, and it's great, but it's also stressful. So I think you're going to see as many different arrangements for learning pods as there are families. Dr. Mbengo was talking about the learning centers that EPS is creating. I think you can think about those or as a piece of a learning pod, learning pod arrangement that some families are going to use so that they can supplement remote-only instruction for childcare, for oversight for kids. In the press, we've seen reports that are, I think, refer to something that's happening like very rarely among the most affluent people in our communities, where families are hiring tutors. And sometimes hiring tutors who are going to be, live in the home and work individually with their children. So we're talking about expenditures of thousands of dollars a month in order to provide in-home care and instruction to their kids. I think more common, we're seeing families team up. In some cases, to hire a professional. In some cases, to do a sort of child care cooperative, where one parent will oversee things and provide supplemental opportunities to kids one day, another parent another day, and so on through the week. We've seen children, we're seeing families draft family members, grandparents, to come into the home to help. In some cases, I've heard of teachers or former teachers opening centers in their home, and so inviting children in to many, many different arrangements. And also, there are families who are homeschooling, and so doing individualized family-specific home learning. So many, many different ways that people are trying to make do and come up with a system that's going to work for them this year.
And in some of these more public conversations about these learning pods, there has been a lot of questions raised about equity and education equity and how certain families being able to hire tutors or create space for or have the finances to support these learning pods could excel the learning of their students, while some of the other students who don't have that option are left further behind. And I want to hear a clip from Sonia Mathias. She's a certified mental health counselor, tutor, and homeschooler in Durham. And she homeschools her nephew and assists her niece in online instruction. And she's been doing some research about learning pods and has some concerns about the inequities baked into the model. So let's hear what she had to say.
You leave out that group of kids who family doesn't have the income, who parents have to go to work, who are from single-parent households. What about them? They going to be stuck online with the Virtual Academy, and if schools, I'm understanding, supposed to give out computers, but if mom or dad is, you know, not computer intelligent, then what? If you have, you know, a Spanish-speaking family and the child doesn't understand the material, then what? There's no such thing, I guess, as fairness. It's a separation for the haves and the have-nots, the privileged and the non-privileged. That's what's happening with this pod stuff, which, in my opinion, is not okay.
That's Sonia Mathias, a mental health counselor, tutor, and homeschooler in Durham. I'm talking with Thad Domina, professor in the UNC Chapel Hill School of Education. So, you know, you think a lot about education equity and achievement gaps. Are you concerned about the shift to these models as far as it relates to education inequity?
Incredibly concerned. I think she's absolutely right. I think that, you know, one of the most important things about schooling, in particular public schooling, is that it provides kids from all walks of our very diverse and very unequal society a common set of experiences, or at least a relatively common set of experiences, exposure to a set of shared values, shared sets of knowledges, shared socialization. It teaches us to live together, right? And it's hugely important. And so the risk to our democracy, to our social fabric, by having kids move out and spend a year or however long it's going to be in separate learning environments is terrifying. These are unprecedented times. You know, I think that districts are doing the smart thing, the safe thing, but there are enormous risks. She's absolutely right.
I mean, and we know that even, you know, the summer vacation can cause a setback for students in learning. So as we move to virtual and all of these challenges continue to increase, from an education equity and kind of long-term education equity standpoint, what do you think are going to be the biggest challenges moving forward to recoup the learning lost in this time?
You know, I think in some ways we're going to be looking at a lost month or a lost year of schooling for a lot of kids. And I think you're right. We know very well that there's a summer slide in student skills. When kids come home, many students take a step back in their skills. And we also know that summer slide is unequal across race and socioeconomic status. So that summer slide tends to widen skills inequality. So I think it makes, I think when we come back, as we come back, we'll have to be very, very laser-centered on questions of equity and on providing opportunity to try to remedy some of those inequalities that are going to happen when kids are learning at home.
As we talked to the superintendents, we noted that some parents are choosing to remove their students from the public school system and choose private schools. Obviously, this is going to impact the funding that these schools get down the line because funding is based on enrollment. So looking at our public education system in North Carolina in particular, what do you think about kind of the impact that COVID-19 could have on the system at large and funding for the system moving forward?
I think these are really uncertain times, and so I think it's hard to say. I think state budgets and local budgets are taking a hit. I think if families do move out of the public schools, that's going to exacerbate that problem. I really appreciated what Dr. Mendenga was saying about families leaving the public schools. I think he was being diplomatic, so I can be a little bit less diplomatic. I think that it's a mistake. I think the same health threat that our children face in public schools, they'll face in private schools. And so I don't think it makes sense to move children into in-person learning environments at this moment. It doesn't strike me as wise, and I think it's also something that presents a very fundamental threat to public schooling moving forward.
You're a parent, and I'm sure you've been in conversations with other parents. I'm curious about what you think families should be doing to prioritize connectedness in this time and overall well-being for their students, apart from these concerns about learning.
I think it's a great question. So in the spring, you know, we heard the school leaders talk about how the spring was just a rush and just crisis mode. But one thing that I noticed teachers doing really well is sort of attending to students' socio-emotional learning. So the teachers, my kids' teachers, were providing opportunities for kids to get together and socialize online. They were providing prompts for kids to do something kind for neighbors, for friends, for family members. And I think those really matter. And so I'm really encouraged to hear Dr. Moore and Dr. Mbenga talk about how central wellness is to the way they've thought about virtual only learning. Trusting the public schools is a piece of providing for kids socio-emotional learning. I think we also just need to, as parents and as citizens, practice a sort of grace. These are not normal times. We're living through an unprecedented crisis. None of us asked for, and we have to just breathe. We have to breathe. We have to be kind to ourselves, be kind to one another, and just try to get through it. We're in survival mode. And I think conveying that, you know, conveying that calm to our children, cultivating that kindness and conveying it to our children, modeling it, is the most important thing we can be doing right now.
Thad Domina is a sociologist and professor in the UNC Chapel Hill School of Education. Thank you so much for talking today.
Thanks for having me.
You can find out more about all of our guests we spoke with today at our website, stateofthings.org. And one exciting note before we go, regular listeners to The State of Things know our series Embodied. It's conversations that I host about sex, relationships, and health. We've talked about everything from body hair to the science of getting a good night's sleep. And now those conversations have a second home on Embodied, the podcast from WUNC. Make a note to subscribe on your favorite podcast app soon, and you can check out the trailer right now at wunc.org/embodied. The State of Things is produced by Amanda Magnus, Grant Holub-Mormon, Kaya Finlay, and Stacia Brown. Josie Taurus is our intern, and Jenny Lawson is our technical director. Al Wodarski also helped engineer today's show. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Anita Rao.